Blog Talk Radio.
You're in the bullpen with Dr. T, hosted by Dr. Marvin Thompson, an empowering educator featured on CNN, PBS, CBS Morning Show, and the Oprah Winfrey Network. In the Bullpen with Dr. T covers the relevant issues of the day affecting our schools, families, and communities. Here's your host, Dr. T.
Good evening. Tonight, we're going to talk about a topic I'm going to assume that many of you have heard of. And I would probably be in that boat if I were not included in an email thread that is conducted with a group of journalists and researchers. And over a course of maybe a month and a half, I started seeing a thread of them discussing something called the Blue Whale Challenge. It did not strike my interest at first, so I pretty much ignored it. But it was a constant discussion that lasted weeks, and I decided to take a peek. When I looked, I was surprised at what I found and how it was going. So let me just quickly describe to you what this game is. It is a challenge, a suicide challenge. And it is allegedly a game. And I say allegedly, and we'll get to that part of it, because here's the thing that struck my interest before I get into it. Last week, as I'm trying to get my head around this issue, the research, and they seem serious about it and concerned, is the phenomenon real? And I asked the same questions. I one word, ditto. I like to know. And I guess Ian Collier is going to break down some of those myths and expose some of the truths and realities around this Blue Whale Challenge. But let me first start by telling you what it is. Very quick facts. The name is derived from the phenomenon of whales typically beast themselves for unknown reasons. Many suggest that it's for suicide reasons, but we're not going to debate that. The name was also reported to have started in Russia in 2013. It is supposedly available in downloadable software or app. It is entered primarily through secret groups. It also assigns 50 tasks to players in a 50-day time frame. And each player has to take photos and upload them for their curator or handler, if you will, to approve. It also allegedly had its first suicide attributed to this. And I say allegedly because this is why we're having this discussion. Back in 2015, and supposedly a Russian psychology student created this game. And he says, allegedly, this is what's attributed to the main purpose for creating the game was to clean the society by 14 people who have no value to commit suicide. And in Russia, again, another quick fact. In Russia in 2016, blue whale became a huge craze amongst teenagers. It caused suicides in this country. As per reports, more than 100 teenagers have allegedly committed suicide to complete the challenge. The last thing I described this from a quote website that is called, not asserting them as facts. This is why I brought someone on board tonight for us to clarify what is real and what isn't real. Just to give you an idea, I know I mentioned Russia. You're going to hear tonight how broad this issue is. But just to give you an idea, this week, today, community, this challenge, out of an 11-year-old boy in his county, who I'm going to assume the police participating in this Blue Whale Challenge. Folks, tonight, again, I don't know enough about it other than to ask the question and to say it needs to be cleared up or at least clarified. If we don't know anything else tonight, what I want to walk away with is clarification. And I have as a guest, and I feel very lucky to have access to her. When she comes on, she sent me her bio, and I saw a video that she did in a Geneva TED Talk at a World Summit May of last year, and it was phenomenal. I will post that video on my Dr. T Educates Facebook page later for you to review, because even if you do not connect to this topic, the things that she mentions there are insightful in this TED Talk. Our guest tonight is journalist and youth advocate Ann Collier. She has been chronicling the public discourse about youth and digital media since 1997. You do the math on that. That's a long time. She is currently the executive director of a national nonprofit organization, the Net Safety Collaborative, and founder of ICanHelp.org. I could sit here and read her bio for the next 20 minutes, but I do have to point out some highlights that I think will give you some understanding of the magnitude and scope of her knowledge and experience with this and the respect that she has in this industry. She has spoken widely on this subject and gave her most recent talk. I've referenced the Heart of Digital Citizenship at TEDx Geneva during the ITU's World Summit on Information Technology. She has served on three national task forces on youth and internet safety, including as co-chair of the Obama administration's Online Safety and Technology Working Group, which was delivered its report to Congress entitled Youth Safety on a Living Internet. Again, I could go on and on, but I won't, because I like to get right to our guest. Ann Collier, welcome to the bullpen.
Hi, Marvin. Great to be here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. I'm so glad you joined us. And I, you know, you and I had a great conversation last week. I planned it to be a 10-minute call just to be mindful of your time. And I think we must have spoke for at least 45 minutes, and it could have gone on.
Yeah.
But you are a breath of knowledge, and you just went on about this topic. And I think it's something that many parents who aren't aware need to be aware, because I have for so long believed, Nancy, and this is why I was so appreciative of your TED Talk, that many parents, although conscious of the impact of social media and the internet, do not truly understand how it can impact their children's lives right in front of their eyes.
Yeah, it's just so important that we get this right. Right? We need to tell our kids the truth.
Well, let's start with just demystifying this blue whale challenge. As I did my research after speaking with you, I found that there are Twitter hashtags dedicated to this blue whale.
Yeah.
And it is really, when I say catching on, I don't want it to, but at least there is awareness. Is this a real phenomenon?
Well, it's clickbait. It's mostly clickbait. There are a lot of different ways to describe it. It's a perfect storm of fear exploitation, exploiting our fears, right? Our fears about the impacts of social media, our fears for our children, our fear of death, you know, all of those things. It's sad to me that something could have this kind of, it could go viral to this degree because of that, right? Mm-hmm. It's also extremely disrespectful of our children. And I can explain, I can go into that later, but let's just sort of talk about what it is first. Does everybody
our
audience knows what clickbait is?
Let's assume they don't. Let's assume that we don't. We have a wide array of audiences and age groups. This show is heard in 16 countries, which is this is the perfect topic to be discussing for an international community. So I think that's important. So do not think, and I learned this as a teacher, don't assume your students know what you know.
Right, right. So clickbait is sort of a new term that came with the advent of social media. It's defined as an eye-catching link, right, on a website. And usually it's, you know, very, very sensationalist or it definitely grabs your eyeballs and it grabs your imagination. It might maybe, you know, a super sexy celebrity. It may be a super scary headline, you name it, but that's what clickbait is. And it's designed to draw traffic, which grows ad dollars, right? So that's kind of what we used to call sensationalist journalism or yellow journalism. It's all about money.
And that clickbait is used to draw these young people in. And one of the quick facts that I mentioned earlier, it said that many of the sites are they're downloadable software and apps that are hidden in other challenges like the ice bucket challenge.
Yeah, the ice bucket challenge was a good use of clickbait, right? It wasn't really clickbait. It was a way to draw attention to an important social need, right? And to get everybody involved in raising money for that purpose. I guess you could call that clickbait. Usually it's used in a really negative way. And just to give you a feel for this particular, for Blue Whale, there was actually an investigation done in Russia, and it turned up between October 2016 and this past February, 232,000 unique uses of the Blue Whale hashtag in Russia alone. That's clickbait. The Russian social network site VKontakte, which was, it's really kind of Russia's Facebook, and unlike in many other countries where Facebook's number one, it's probably, you know, right up there with Facebook in popularity. And VKontakte itself identified tens of thousands of bots, not real people, using those hashtags. So they create bots to pull people into a subject and to get more and more tweets. And, you know, the head of the organization that administers Russia's ru.ru domain, like we have .us, they have .ru, said that there are three types of users of the hashtags, the blue whale hashtags, besides apparent members or followers of these so-called death groups. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But the one kind is the curious, trying to find out more about a trend, right? So that's what clickbait is supposed to draw. Advertisers is the second one, capitalizing on it to promote what they're marketing. And the third is just professionals testing technologies for information dissemination, right? So sort of a technical use of hashtags. So it's a lot more complicated than story that a lot of people are sharing.
Well, and this is what I wanted to clarify. You mentioned a huge number of sites and hashtags dedicated to Blue Whale that have nothing to do with this. Could I surmise that whoever created this Blue Whale challenge just capitalized on the popularity of that particular pattern?
Well, I kind of doubt that there's any one person or organization. And it's really, really murky, right? And we should probably talk about the big picture, sort of the historical picture too, because this is really unprecedented. We had something go hugely viral in this country and then spread from here to other parts of the world. But it started here in 2012, and it was a fundraising effort, and it involved YouTube and got millions and millions of views extremely fast. That's the only thing that I can think of in the past decade that is even close to this. But this started we're not quite sure. It could be either Russia or Kyrgyzstan. And these are cultures and political systems that we don't understand. We can't assume that they have independent news media separate from the government. And we can't assume that it was started by somebody with criminal intent. It could have been somebody in a government, right? Or it could have been purely commercial. We can't really know, but it definitely started in different countries.
Well,
and it has literally spread all over the world. You know, I've been talking with colleagues this week in India about what's going on there with Blue Whale.
And it is really, in our discussion, you mentioned how big that is. They're having significant issues with this blue whale challenge there.
Yeah, it kind of, so the history is, as far as we can tell, I have a friend and colleague in the Czech Republic who's done some really serious investigative work on this, and he found that what happened in Russia was never even referenced blue whale until this year. And it was supposed or alleged, quote unquote, death groups or groups of death that were started in Vkontakte, their social network there, by so-called curators or facilitators who, you know, would sort of supposedly guide people through the 50 steps of the challenge, never labeled blue whale. That started in Kyrgyzstan, and people don't really know why. It was first reported in the main news agency there, which is pretty close to government. It's the press there isn't quite as independent as it is over here in the West. There is independent media, news media in Russia, but there's been a lot of sort of disdain or you know, a lot of snark around how it took off in Russia, because a fairly independent and legitimate news, so-called news organization, I don't know anything about it, right? Novaya Gazeta published a piece, and the writer was nicknamed Clickbait, you know, like Miss Clickbait, because of her piece, and that never even mentioned the term blue whale in it. But that is what people started picking up on, is claiming 130 suicides. And that 130 suicides was for a period of 6 months. It was minors, and it was the total number of suicides in, I think, Russia and possibly Ukraine over that period. And we know from research that there's never a single cause of suicide. And even the guy who was arrested as supposedly involved in death groups in Russia said it was 17, and even that's a horribly high number. But it just shows that the numbers are all over the map, and there's no way of knowing if there's any actual link to death groups or a so-called game and a particular death of a child.
And, you know, your clarification of this is important, because today, as I mentioned, there was an 11-year-old who committed suicide, and in his town, the sheriff went on the news to warn people about this challenge, and he stated this as fact. He even went so far as to acknowledge that it began in Russia. He actually stated that the individual who did this was arrested and is now in prison for it. I did not read that anywhere. As a matter of fact, I read that they could not convict him. I do know that there was a man who was questioned about it, interrogated, but they could not charge him. That's what I read. Okay.
Yeah,
so the sheriff.
That's,
go ahead.
Yeah. That Philip Budjikin, I think he's 21.
Yes.
He was actually held without trial for a long time because there wasn't enough evidence. So, you know, we don't understand the criminal justice system in Russia, but he was associated with as having bipolar disorder. And at one point he was claiming to be a curator. At another point he denied any guilt. You know, it's that too is really murky, but he was finally arrested. I think he was held for over a year without trial. And there's speculation that there was great pressure on the on a judge or the police to arrest somebody in this case because of this sensationalist story.
And this is what scares me. We have a law enforcement officer at the death of a young man who goes out and purports this information to the American public. And again, as you said, it's bigger in other countries, but it is getting attention here. It is getting there's some awareness.
Yeah.
And he's reporting
this.
And I'm not criticizing him. And I'm not criticizing him because he's actually a victim of the same type of clickbait and misinformation that's out here today. So hopefully
and
you will
I
hear
think
this.
It, we,
go ahead.
Yeah, I hope so too. And I hope See, the problem is there's always pressure, no matter what country you're in, if you're a reporter or an editor, there's always pressure to get a story out, especially after a tragedy like a child suicide has happened, right, before there's an investigation. And so we don't know. Usually what we see in the news, you know, precedes any facts about a case, and the facts emerge much later. So we have to know that, and we have to ask, okay, so if there is, if a link has been made between this child's death and a so-called game, what is the evidence of that? And was the child, you know, have we looked at a search history, and have we seen references to something, or is there evidence that something like this so-called challenge has actually been played, that there's actually, that steps have been taken, that there was some criminal or, you know, involved in curating this death. We just don't know. And, you know, I just am thinking about a story that came out in the Irish Republic, right, where it was really, really bad journalism. But, and I think this may have happened in this country too, where a parent, you know, talks about blue whale at dinner, and then a child sort of checks it out and may find references to it in the news media, you know, and we don't know, was the child healthy or was the child super vulnerable? Was the child struggling with depression? You know, these are questions that we need to ask, and we need to understand whether there was an exploration of this thing going on, or if there was an actual activity, right? And whether that stemmed from suicidal thoughts, depression, etc. There's just a whole lot we need to know. We can't jump to conclusions about this.
And you're so right. And this is what intrigued me about the thread of emails that I saw with the researchers. And folks, you need to know that the group of people who were emailing back and forth, and I'm going to let you describe, I'm going to describe them, and you can tell the details, but these are some very bright people, and they're very accomplished people in their fields. They have some of the most intriguing discourse and informative discourse. I wish all of us discussed issues this way, but they deal with facts and they question each other. And ultimately, there is always a fact-based conclusion. And that is something you can't find every day. Nancy, I mean, and could you quickly give an overview of the backgrounds of some of these people? Because, again, I would have never known about this in this way. And I probably would have heard this sheriff and assume, because he's a public official reporting information in the best interest of the public, I'm sure his intentions are good, and I'd have run with it. You have a journalistic background, which is an asset.
Yeah, I do. It's a Google group, and it was started by a woman in Oregon named Nancy Willard, who has done a lot of great work in the area of bullying prevention and internet safety, and she's very, very research-based, and she gathered a bunch of us, those of us sort of in the youth advocacy and internet safety space, and some of the top researchers, you know, in various countries, but mostly in the U.S., in both youth online risk and internet, you know, which is kind of the technical term for internet safety, and bullying prevention and cyberbullying prevention. So there are a lot of great people in it, and they sort of come and go, and I don't know who they all are because it's, you know, it's online, right? But
right.
It's always a lively conversation. And David Stein in the Czech Republic is in this group and has really done some fine work investigating sort of the background on sensationalist news stories that seem to capture the public attention and go viral.
Well, I feel very fortunate to be a part of it. And it was Nancy who invited me to join the group and be, you know, just, and I just said, I just want to sit on the sidelines, and I've been impressed. When we look at this, here's the conclusion that I come to just based on the non-facts. is that it seems to be more opportunistic on the part of whomever started this to capitalize on an already existing phenomenon regarding and behaviors regarding teen suicide and instability and insecurities.
Yeah, I think so. And I really want, we need to talk about why we need to tell our children the truth. I think if we can save a little time for that, that's really important. Why this is really a concern. Because I remember Dan Rydenberg, who is the executive director of SAVE and one of our top suicide prevention experts in this country, calling me the other day and saying, Ann, how do we get in front of this? He was testifying on Capitol Hill about it. And, you know, it's like this you know, comes at us and we have to just really scramble to try to respond intelligently and thoughtfully and to calm fears. And it's really hard when something is this grabby and scary, right? But it's interesting. There was a piece in Bloomberg that talked about a 14-year-old girl who, you know, knows all about blue whale and talks about it very calmly and mockingly, but she mentioned casually that she has friends who, you know, if not going as far as jumping off a tall building, like, you know, apparently it's allegedly the 50th step in the Blue Whale Challenge urges people to do, they you know, she worries that they would cut themselves to draw attention or to, you know, there are kids who are very, very vulnerable, right? I think most kids who are healthy would, you know, either, you know, not take this too seriously. They would do something like one girl who is described as having done a couple of steps as a joke. And when the curator asked her to cut out a whale, she cut a cartoon cat from, you know, a newspaper. And the Russian words for cat and whale are very close. They're kot and kit. And so she just did that and then, you know, didn't take it seriously at all. The administrator supposedly became very angry and said that they'd send people to harm her. And she said, well, let me come down to meet them. The elevator isn't running and they may not have the energy to climb all the stairs to our 8th floor apartment. And right. And then, of course, no one shows up. And, you know, I really think that, you know, that's one response that kids have is they'll sort of be curious. They'll explore. They heard about it in the, you know, all the superintendent of school sending a letter home or something in the news or their parents saying something at the dinner table. And so they'll look into it. They'll maybe talk about it a little bit. And some of them will actually just toy with these people. They might find a so-called group or somebody who's, you know, creepy and mess around, mess with their heads and just, you know, make it sort of a group prank. I think, you know, that's as likely a response as any, but some of these kids are vulnerable. And that's what we have to, you know, really think about, because the social norms research says that perception affects behavior. And, you know, in one medical journal, a researcher said that exposure to peer social norms that favored risk or risk-taking predicted a significant increase in risk-taking. So if we exaggerate the risk-taking and it goes viral and we're talking about it a whole lot, it starts to seem normal and more people are, you know, it's possible that more people will engage in that behavior. This has been found to be true in academic research done in New Jersey middle schools around bullying, right? But when kids are told the truth, that this actually isn't normative behavior and most kids don't engage in it, they're less likely to. Perception actually changes behavior. So that's one reason why it's so important to tell our kids the truth, the facts. And when we sort of try to go to the facts with them, kind of ask these intelligent questions about whether the investigation was complete and whether or not there even was any kind of person behind something that they saw online who was threatening them. When we ask these questions, that's really good media literacy education, right? Rather than mm-hmm. trying to block it, block them out of it or ban it, you know, just not go there, not talk about it, you know. It's good to appeal to their native intelligence, I think.
Well, this goes into some of the things you talked about at the Geneva Summit regarding the term you talked about it specifically. And one of the things that struck me, there were several, but crisis language stuck with me because I find we do that we speak to our young people and we use crisis language that does not help them. Can you explain the concept of the use of crisis language in regards to our children?
Well, I think that for 15 or 20 years now that we've had internet safety as a field, we've been representing our young people as mostly potential victims, sometimes potential perpetrators too, right? That kind of language is really disrespectful of them and really, you know, goes to worst case scenarios, which is kind of what crisis language is, right? If we try to change, you know, it seems to be human nature to try to change behavior using fear and fear campaigns. But we know from the research that really doesn't work if the campaign itself or the message of the campaign is not relevant to the child or any listener. And if it's not actionable, if there's nothing they can do about it. So it's really, really important to use, as I've learned from Dr. Finkelhor at the University of New Hampshire, a sociologist there, it's really important to have clear language to use, not so much fear campaigns, but, you know, wear a safety helmet, fasten your seatbelt, don't start forest fires with matches, you know, that kind of clear language,
okay.
Actionable, you know, it has to be relevant to them, right? Rather than creating a predator panic and saying there are bad people everywhere online, because that's not their experience. That's not relevant to them. And so what happens when we don't sort of tell them the truth and we just try to scare the crap out of them is they just mock it. And very often they'll engage in the very behavior we don't want them to, because it's just not, you know, the message isn't relevant to them.
And what you just described is exactly what parents fear, that if I tell them the truth, then they'll want to do it. And what you're saying is tell them the truth so they'll know and make good judgments.
Yeah, what I mean, like in the case of bullying and cyberbullying, the truth is that most kids don't engage in that kind of behavior. You know, we know somewhere around a quarter of all kids have ever experienced cyberbullying. And it's more like a third with in-person bullying at school. In-person bullying is still more of a problem, but still the vast majority of kids, you know, 70 to 75% don't engage in cyberbullying. You tell a kid that, they will, oh, that's normal. My peers and I are, you know, basically pretty good people, right? And that perception, that understanding of the actual reality based on research in your school, which is how these social norms researchers did it in New Jersey middle schools, changes their behavior even more. It's pretty powerful.
It is, and I've seen that work. We have – hold on a second, Ann. We have a caller on the line. It is, I believe, my good friend from the north, from Canada, Dr. Vibe. Hello, Dr. Vibe. Is that you?
It is me. How are you, Dr. T?
I'm doing fine, my friend. I'm glad you joined us tonight. What's on your mind?
Well, my alleged mind or my mind. But I'll just say, Ms. Collier, thank you so much for everything you've done, you're doing, and you're going to do. This is a very important conversation. I can't stay on for too long because I've got a conversation to do at the top of the hour. But I have a question for you. In the light of, it looks like the American federal government cutting back on education funding, Where does the role of education play in regards to bullying, education of our future when it comes to this subject? And how much concern do you have in regards to this subject?
That is such an important question. I'm concerned about the kind of education kids get. There are some really great programs out there, the Olvaeus program and PBIS, and you know, lots of really great evidence-based work for bullying and cyberbullying prevention. And we know more and more about cyberbullying as basically a subset of bullying itself. Schools still seem to have funds for these programs. One of the things that we've learned in recent years is that the major part of bullying prevention is social-emotional learning. And we also know that social-emotional learning, which is a clear set of skills that children can be taught and is an academic standard in, I think, 4 states now at the elementary school level, that can improve academic performance too. So it's both social success and academic and future professional success that we get from social emotional learning. So I think there is some really good, solid evidence-based education that and instruction that schools are adopting, and more, in fact, my friends here in Seattle at Committee for Children, who designed the decades-old and recently updated Second Step program for bullying prevention and social emotional learning. Their phone's ringing off the hook. There, a lot of schools are ordering Second Step now. So I think there's some encouraging news in this area, and I think we're getting smarter about what's going to help solve the problem. But we have a long way to go.
Well, you know what? I'm going to jump off. I just wanted to get in quickly, and I was really enjoying the conversation. But thank you for your answer and everything that you're doing.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for jumping in.
No problem, Dr. T. Have a great rest of the show, both of you.
All right, buddy. Talk to you soon. Well, and he mentioned, he brought up a good point, bullying in schools, and I had Nancy on the show at least twice to discuss this. I did an entire series on bullying, particularly at the height of the election and the campaigning of last year.
Yeah.
We saw bullying just go through the roof, and schools already started, and we're seeing it again. This blue whale challenge phenomenon, to me, and this is just Marvin speaking, and I know you know more about this than I do, but my thought is this. It is the tail wagging the dog, because we have yet to address the symptoms and the issues that lead to our young people being susceptible to things such as, fake or not, the blue whale challenge. And one of the points that you brought up in your TED talk I found fascinating was that adults' concerns and fears shape public policy agenda and not children's concerns or interests or experiences.
Yeah.
And I think that to me stuck to why we haven't dealt with the symptoms.
Yeah, I think it's pretty tragic that we don't talk with our kids enough. You know, there was this awful headline in Atlantic Monthly, I think about a week ago, or this month's issue, about, you know, our smartphones destroying a generation. Just a ridiculous headline. And it was on top of a book excerpt by a researcher who another researcher has said has made a career out of being very negative about teenagers. In the last decade, Jean Twenge wrote a book about the narcissism epidemic, referring to teens, now the millennial generation. And so now she's writing about smartphones destroying the mental health of Generation Z, what she calls iGen. We keep making these pronouncements about our children without really talking with them. There has been some beautiful research that actually talked with kids, both on the other side of the Atlantic and this side of the Atlantic. There have been some really good studies, but they're definitely in the minority. And one of the researchers who pushed back against Gene Twenge's pronouncement about Generation Z, our today's teenagers, said, well, you know, wait a minute, smartphones were in our hands first as parents. They came out when, you know, we were parents first, and then we would hand them down to our kids. And as they were growing up, smartphones really, you know, kids weren't the first adopters of them. And this was a woman named Samuel. I'm trying to remember. I think she's in Vancouver, and she's a really wonderful researcher and writer who suggested that smartphones actually have distracted us, and kids are now crying out for our attention. They need our attention. They need us to listen to them. And I think that will help them a great deal. You know, when we're talking about these huge issues, these sea changes in media and technology, these things you can't extrapolate from the headlines into your child, you know, what kind of impact technology and media are having on him or her. You have to work from the kid out. You have to talk with your kid, because it's their experience that with technology that informs what their lives are going to be like, right? It's really, really not possible to generalize. It's so situational and individual.
You said, I think, is what's at the essence of some of the issues we have or our young people have. It's not that we have with them. I always say that whatever problems our young people are having, it is a result of something we have yet to do. And if we view it that way, instead of looking at them, because that's the easy way. It's always easy to look at the patient and blame them. Then I don't have to do anything. You just say, get better. You know,
well, it's even easier to blame the technology these days, right? That's really lazy, I think.
Yeah, that's really lazy. And, you know, years ago, I used to tell parents who would sit in front of me, and once they began to understand their child's deficits and I'd give them strategies, they would say to me almost apologetically, you know, Mr. T, I don't know how to do that. And I was never a good student. And it was the easiest. I can tell you, when I gave them this answer, Nancy, I keep calling you Nancy, Ann, when I give them this answer, you could feel the relief, the release of stress. And the answer I gave was the truth. The truth is, ma'am, sir, the only thing that matters in your child's success is that you care about their success. They're going to do the work. They just need you to support them and know that you believe that they can do it. And
I wholeheartedly agree.
Overwhelming.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks I've got to get my kid. I'm telling you, more than anything, I've seen children turn around when their parents take an interest in what they're doing or what they're saying. It changes things.
Yeah, I mean, don't we all work better if we feel respected and encouraged? And why wouldn't we do that for our children?
Exactly. I know I do. I'm not one who is averse to a pat on the back or a little encouragement. I could not have accomplished a third of the things I ever did if I didn't have people supporting me. And support could be criticism. But I knew the criticism came from somewhere. My children and I, we always talk about this, and people ask them, your dad's pretty strict. You know, I bet, you know, you got whipped a couple of times or a few times. And they went, no, I only got spanked twice. He usually explained things to us, and he asked us, how were we going to fix it? And he held us accountable to that, and he helped us do it. And it was easy. I became not just a better parent, but I became a better person. And I think sometimes in parenting, I know I'm going off the rails here, but I think sometimes in parenting, we think that we are the givers only to children. And if we begin to realize that relationship is transferable, there's a lot of things that we can gain from just engaging with them in the ways that we're talking about.
I don't think you did go off the rails. I think this is absolutely central to the whole discussion. You know, we have to talk with our kids. I mean, the American Association of Pediatrics changed their guidance on screen time because, well, you know, I'm going to say it very colloquially. They saw how stupid it was. They saw that you can't like give a certain number of hours, you know, sort of prescribe a limit on screen time when screen time is something different for every single individual you talk to, right?
Describe
screen time. There are a
gazillion
uses of a screen.
Yeah.
What?
Describe screen time for our audience.
Screen time is time on screen. That simple. When people talk about it, and researchers are really discrediting the whole concept, because you know, if is it a mobile screen, is it a tablet screen, is it a laptop screen? What kind of screen are we talking about? Because we have different uses for each of those kinds of devices, and then there are, you know, well over a million apps available for that little mobile screen. And some of those are education apps, some of those are productivity apps, some of them are games, some of them are purely social, right? So how ridiculous to say anything at all about screen time. And that's what the, it's not the APA, it's the AAP, right? The Pediatrics Association, I think, kind of came around to, but there are researchers who have said that they didn't go far enough. So, we have to get smart about this. We have to get a little more granular and a little more truthful and a little more respectful.
I agree. 110%. Well, what's going on in your world? I know with the nonprofit that you run, you all provide services and supports to schools and communities regarding internet safety, as well as some of these bullying behaviors. And I read on your website that it's a very nominal fee to get these types of protections in schools.
Yeah, well, very nice of you to ask. I help run iCanHelpline.org, which is basically a social media helpline for schools. So for a $300 subscription, a school can sign up for a year's worth of help. And then when anything happens in social media and in our country, and this is just for schools in our country, usually it's Instagram or Snapchat, sometimes Twitter, sometimes Musical.ly, possibly in Kick Messenger. Those are the places where stuff happens most, because that's where most kids spend their time in social media these days. And so we can, because of relationships that I've had with the companies for some time, we can help escalate things that haven't been taken down, you know, bad stuff like fake profiles or mean posts or that type of stuff. We can get it taken down with the help of the social media company, by and large. Not always, but by and large, and especially if the young users involved are under 13.
That is a wonderful service, because social media bullying is, I mean, it's taken on a life of its own. There's so many cases and incidents. I could do a whole show just documenting those. But it's a dangerous, isolated place for young people to be without those protections. And, you know, parents can't be everywhere. You mentioned the many forms and reasons kids use the multiple screens that they do, whether it be an iPad or a cell phone or a laptop. They all have different uses depending on that.
Yeah, they do. But what they do online is very much a reflection of their peer group and their social circles, right? So It's really much more about our humanity than our technology. And it's really not as daunting for parents as we've been led to believe. And I don't think we have to fear it that much, because it's really a matter of talking with our kids and understanding, you know, asking kind of loving, open-hearted, genuinely curious questions like, so what's your favorite app? Can you show me how it works? Can Why don't I use it with you? Or you could make that a rule. In our house, if you use Snapchat, I use it with you. And every now and then I'm going to check in on what you're doing. Other parents would say, you know, if all's going well, I'm going to have your back. If it's not going well, let me know. Keep me posted. Everybody has a different parenting style, but for the most part, you know when something is upsetting your child. And very often, if it's social, it will involve social media, but not be exclusively about social media, because what we see in social media is kind of the tip of the iceberg. It's just the digital representation of what's going on in their peer group. Does that make sense?
It does. It does indeed. And I'm going to get back to the whole blue whale thing for a minute in terms of it's the end result, the end game, which is suicide. And I want to remind the audience, we're not just talking about internet use and being nice to your kids, because we're not having this discussion without the blue whale challenge being attributed to young people feeling isolated. There are many, many reasons why young people move towards even thinking about suicide and, more importantly, acting on it. But I don't think if we don't put those things into that context, the entire concept will be lost. Because when we talk about schools and bullying, again, we're looking at the behavior, not the symptoms. We're not treating it. We're managing it. And I always find that when problems persist, it's not a management problem. The problem is you're managing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think a lot of times in our homes with our young people, whatever their issues are, a lot of parents find themselves managing it.
Yeah, and so many of these discussions and so much of the messaging has been aimed at engaged parents. There are kids in this country who are literally dealing with trauma, whether it's because of the neighborhoods they live in, it's because of what's going on at home, it's because of what's going on at school. It's no particular race or ethnic group, but you know, lots of kids can be exposed to social aggression and social victimization. But the kids who deal with it most, whether it's in-person bullying or cyberbullying, are special ed kids and LGBTQ kids. They're the ones who deal with it the most. And one of our foremost experts in bullying, Dorothy Espelage at the University of Florida, has said that the root cause of so much bullying and then even dating abuse and sexual assault at the college level starts at middle school with homophobic name calling. And that's how we get to the root of this. It's, you know, when kids have engaged parents, when they're that fortunate and there can be conversations at home about respect and civility for their peers and respecting fellow human beings regardless of their orientation or their ethnicity or their race, those conversations have to happen. But this education is really going to take a village. It's, you know, you have to have good classroom culture. You have to have teachers who feel safe about creating solid guided practice in social behavior. You have to have schools that support those teachers. You have to have administrators who do. You know, it's a whole ecosystem, and positive school climate really is the ultimate solution. That's what we're aiming for, positive school climate for everybody. No more zero tolerance, as much social, you know, social literacy practiced and restorative rather than punitive practices as we can muster, and really treating our kids with respect.
Our kids are labeled quite a bit, and this is why your statement about crisis language stuck with me, because words stick with young people. The most of us, you and I, we build up calluses. You know, I didn't have cell phones when I grew up. I didn't even have a pager. We talked through smoke signals. You know, that's where I was.
I know, right?
So
I know.
You know, my whole world was a lot different, and I think the immediacy and the constant barrage of information and the ability to access people to bully them. When I went home, I might not see the kid who was talking trash to me for days or weeks, but I could get off the bus being bullied, and by the time I get into my home, it continues from the time I go to bed until the time I get up, and it never stops. None of us have grown up in that environment, and this is, I think, all the more reason many of the things that you talk about and you've mentioned here tonight are so critical in terms of reconnecting with our children.
Yeah, reconnecting with our children, not being afraid of technology. I mean, I remember Sherry Turkle at MIT talking, you know, her book called Alone Together, and the claim that we're all on devices in the same room and not paying any attention to each other. I don't think that's necessarily true. But I think we need to be mindful of how much we're being exposed ourselves to the constant barrage of information and what it's doing to our hearts and minds, you know, whether we're just looking at domestic politics all the time and seeing what's going on there or whatever, or a kid is being constantly exposed to gossipy, crappy, you know, drama at school. All of that stuff, we need to think about the impact that it's having. And I think, you know, we talk so much about digital detox and digital Sabbath and powering down and all that stuff. And yeah, that's good. That's fine. But ultimately what we have to have is a judgment detox. Ultimately what we have to do is, you know, think more and care more and pay attention more to each other. And, you know, that's hard to do. That's hard to teach, and it's, you know, but that's kind of what it's about. It's not about technology.
It really isn't. And I think technology has taken over our lives, sadly. And I think we have lost that personal connection with one another. And if we can't do it as grown-ups, how in the hell are we going to do it with kids?
Right. We've got to start there.
Well, and in summation, what would you say to parents or anyone listening about this blue whale phenomenon? Because your group has educated me tremendously. In our conversation we had the other day, and again tonight, I always learn something new. What is it that you would like them to know and think about this blue whale phenomenon as they hear about it?
I think the most important thing to do would be to ask your kid, have you heard about anything like some sort of blue whale game or challenge or whatever? And if they nod their head, so what did you hear? Do you know that we can't be sure what's true or false about that? Have any of your friends talked about it? What do they say? What are you hearing at school now that kids are back in school in parts of the country? You know, just talk about stuff like you would anything else and see if there's anything to be concerned about. I'd say probably by and large there isn't. But it wouldn't hurt to ask your kid about that. Same thing with 13 Reasons Why. Same thing with anything that sort of takes off and scares people in the news media.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because I referenced that in our conversation last week. You all had a thread about 13 Reasons Why, and I'd shared with you then, and I had some real mixed feelings about that. I thought there were some really good things that people needed to know and see and think about. But there were also some that I thought might be, and again, this is my adult mind, might be suggestive to young people. So I'm very interested in having you back, as well as some of the other experts in that Google chat, to discuss this show, because I think season two is gearing up here soon. I'm just going to throw that out there. I'm going to put it out to the group, and you just kind of back me up and see if we can get someone to come on, because they have some, they have some really good insight and opinions about things, and I do think it would make for a very good dialogue. Although I'm not trying to bring up ratings for this show. It's got good ratings as it is, but it's very topical.
Yep. Yeah. And it's good to get researchers in the mix.
Yeah. In the world of fake news, you guys are a breath of fresh air.
Yeah, we've really, even the definition of fake news keeps changing, right? But we really do need media literacy in this country and everywhere in the world more than ever, I think. So,
I agree.
We can, yeah.
Well, and thank you so much for joining us and taking out an hour of your time to break this down for us and to give us even bring us back to center about what's really important. And I know your time is valuable and it is much appreciated.
Well, it's been a pleasure. Thanks so much. It's been great talking with you, Marvin.
All right. Same here. Well, you take care, and we'll talk soon.
Okay. Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye. Folks, that was Ann Collier, outstanding person, and I feel very fortunate to have access to her and the other people in terms of them sharing their information. Let me just do a quick summary about this. Again, we started the show about a blue whale phenomenon. Supposedly a suicide challenge, supposedly started in Russia. A sheriff in our country, and by the way, started in Russia and it's grown to India and several other countries. And when I say grown, there's no evidence, no evidence whatsoever of the suicides that have been attributed to this phenomenon being accurate. And I think Anne brought up a very good point. We hear that X number of children or a child committed suicide, and they don't give evidence that this person, these supposed suicides, were related to the Blue Whale Challenge. And frankly, folks, that would be easy to do. And here's why. This challenge has a 50-day cycle. Each day, participants are to complete a task each day, culminating in the worst outcome, them taking their own lives. Along that journey, they are to document this by photographs and to a handler, a curator, to approve or disapprove of their commitment towards the challenge. The threat from the curator or the handler, if you don't participate, we will do XXX to you or your family. That's the story. But I think as Anne shared tonight, even when these stories are attributed to them, I want you to understand how to read news. Not just fake news, just news. If that's true, where's the evidence to support you attributing that particular outcome to this stated challenge? The sheriff in this town today, citing the suicide of an 11-year-old, reported the fake news as facts, such as the person who started this was in Russia, and he's now in prison because of it. That is not true. Not only is he not in prison, he was never charged. And I think the issue of the blue whale should stop there, because as long as we put a name to it, it will always be the blue whale challenge. Just like as long as we call bullying bullying, it will always be bullying. Bullying is a result of someone not paying attention to their child's needs. We have strategies to help children who see other children being bullied. But we have yet to come up with strategies to help adults who raise children who bully. We tend to focus so much on the child who's being bullied. And when we do that, we're actually teaching them coping skills by accepting the fact that bullying is cool. It's good. It's going to be here. I'll be the first one to tell you, we're not going to stop bullying. We're not. But what we can do is minimize its impact on our young people to the point that they have to feel like they have to take their lives. And no, Bullying's not the only reason young people do that, but it is a leading reason. It is a leading reason. And bullying comes in many forms. So, in summation, I'd like to say this. I have read these threads from some of the top researchers in the world. I feel very fortunate and lucky and privileged to have access to their intimate conversations as they're developing their research. They're the ones who woke me up to the fact that the blue whale challenge was even out there. But as I talked to them, talked to Anne, read through the literature that they have produced and others have in other countries, there is one conclusion. There is a lot of mania around a hashtag. And I don't mean a hashtag itself. I mean the idea of a challenge that is inciting kids through 50 steps over 50 consecutive days. I don't care if it's a blue whale challenge or the slow snail challenge. If you're listening to this and you have children, you work with children, you come in contact with them. They're not adults, folks. They're on a journey. Some of them stumble, fall, get lost. And with each stumble, if there's no one there to help them and show them the direction and help dust them off, they begin to take on a life of their own. At some point, we're going to have to stop blaming phenomenons, naming things to excuse ourselves of the responsibility from being grown-ups, from being parents, and from being good citizens. I love the mantra of it takes a village, but I'll be damned if I've seen one. I hear it takes a village. Someone stands up in the crowd and says, we need to raise our children like we're in a village, or it takes a village. Usually they're saying it in a dysfunctional community, because real villages live it. They don't talk about it. Well, that's it for tonight, folks. Tomorrow morning, please be sure to join Myla G and I for It Ain't That Early Morning Show. Yes, we will be talking about politics. I don't know how you cannot help, but it's going to be some funny stuff, because I have gained a new perspective on some things, because it's not getting any better. So join us tomorrow as we talk about that and a lot of other current events and, of course, education and things that impact our communities. We will see you tomorrow morning, 8 a.m., for It Ain't That Early Morning Show. Until then, everybody have a great evening.
You've been in the bullpen with Dr. T. Follow Dr. T on Twitter and Facebook at Dr. T Educates. And on the web, visit www.drteducates.com. Join us every Monday at 7 p.m. Eastern in the bullpen with Dr. T. Become empowered. Get involved.